Case number 21-1620, the state of Seth Michael Zecora et al. V. Trey Kreisman et al. 15 minutes for the plaintiff, 15 minutes to be shared by the defendants. Ms. Madeline Sinkovich for the appellants.
Morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. Madeline Sinkovich here on behalf of the plaintiff, which is the estate of Seth Michael Zecora and the personal representative of his mother, Brandy Zecora. And while I know the briefing is rather lengthy in this case, plaintiff's points can boil down into three points. First, prison guards that smuggle illegal drugs in the prisons pose an obvious and a substantial risk of harm to the inmates that are incarcerated therein. Second, prison officials who have knowledge that staff are involved in drug smuggling in prisons and fail to act reasonably in response can be subject to liability under the Eighth Amendment to the United States Constitution. And three, the allegations in plaintiff's complaint here do state a plausible claim for relief against the named defendants for their deliberate indifference to a substantial risk of serious harm that was presented by uncontrolled staff-involved drug smuggling in the Michigan prisons. Accordingly, the district court erred in dismissing plaintiff's complaint. A brief summary of the facts in this case. Like I said, the lawsuit was brought by Ms. Brandy Zecora after the untimely death of her son, Seth Michael Zecora. He was incarcerated in the Michigan Department of Corrections, the MDOC for short, and passed away in 2017. He was only 21 years old at the time of his death and did pass away from fentanyl toxicity. However, prior to his death, the MDOC had several problems with drug smuggling in the prisons.
Can I ask you, the weekend before two people die?
Two people overdosed that same weekend in Lakeland.
Okay.
During the year prior.
Go ahead. Well, that you're getting to what was the...
Did they die?
These two did not die in Lakeland. They were overdosed and sent to the hospital. In the year prior, in the MDOC facilities in general, two employees...
Wait, this prison?
No.
Okay, well, how about this prison? What's the evidence show or the complaint show for the prior year in this prison?
In this prison, there were the two overdoses that recently happened that I just mentioned.
People die or not?
No, they did not die.
They were
hospitalized.
There
are two overdoses in Lakeland the weekend prior to Seth's death.
Right.
In the MDOC in general, there was a problem with drug smuggling where two employees did come forward with evidence of this. And after the first employee came forward, two inmates who were involved in the drug smuggling were killed. So those are the two deaths that I think I might be confusing.
Okay, so I'll start. You can tell me why I'm wrong about this, but I'll start with this prison. And one thing I might wonder about your claim is, let's just say hypothetically, there's a world in which there could be an Eighth Amendment violation for prisons not paying attention to drug smuggling and not paying attention to people overdosing or worse, dying. If in that prison you just have two overdoses the weekend before, and if I'm understanding you correctly, there's no evidence as to what had been going on in that prison. I'm only focused on that prison. You can tell me why I'm wrong, but for now, only that prison. It's hard for me to understand that the theory of that claim. In other words, there's not really time, if it's the weekend before, to solve a systemic problem of, you know, how are you going to do it? You don't know how it came in. The basketball theory didn't come till later. So how does that kind of show how cruel and unusual or unreasonable the prison's being if it's only the weekend before that it happens and there hadn't been prior overdoses or deaths in that prison?
The basketball theory, while it was only told to Miss Brandy Zecora after her son's death, that information that it was frequent that basketballs full of drugs were being thrown over would suggest that the time was farther in the history than just those 2 days.
Okay, so
additionally,
also you have paragraph 29 where you say that another prisoner informed Lakeland Correctional Inspector, specifically Defendant Kreisman and the inspector's office, of the drug smuggling ring.
Exactly. So I'm not sure exactly when he came forward with this information, but it was more than just the weekend before. I think the complaint alleges that it was prior to all three overdoses that he came forward.
There were overdoses before the weekend before?
No.
Remember, it's not just evidence of drug smuggling. The cruel and unusual problem arises, I mean, it could be stupidity, bad prison management, but in terms of protecting the health of the inmates, the real tip is people getting hurt, right?
Correct. But you don't need to wait until someone gets hurt to have an Eighth Amendment violation. You could have a substantial risk of serious harm without someone dying before you can bring that claim. So if I think, to answer your question, the environment that allows guards to smuggle drugs creates in itself a substantial risk of harm to all the inmates. So if officials know that illegal drugs are being smuggled into the prison, there's in general a...
What's funny about this is it's, you know, one thing that makes an Eighth Amendment claim salient is the government restricts the inmates' liberty. They put them in the cell, they have restrictions, and so when they're involuntarily subjected to conditions or not looked at, their medical needs are not looked after, you know, that makes some sense because the government took away their liberty, they can't protect themselves, and you can understand that world. But here it's a voluntary decision. Like, it's not guards saying, take the fentanyl. It's not guards coercing someone into injuring themselves. It's a voluntary decision. That's what seems different to me about this case from other Eighth Amendment cases.
Agreed. But however, Your Honor, this would be similar to a suicide case, whereas an individual who has harmed themselves, but also in
those cases only get somewhere when someone, you know, the way prisons lose those cases is there's a serious medical need. It's almost as if, you know, someone comes in and has to have insulin every day. They're supposed to give them their insulin every day. Once someone's tipped off someone's suicidal, you know, usually prisons don't get in trouble for a suicide where there's no suggestion the person is suicidal. So here, that's not part of the claim, right? That this particular individual couldn't be around drugs. I mean, they're illegal, so that makes the whole thing a little strange anyway. But this isn't a serious medical needs case.
No, it's not a serious medical needs case. It's a general danger in the prison case. So the condition of confinement where there's illegal drugs that are being smuggled in by guards is what plaintiffs said create the dangerous condition in the prison. That is a substantial risk of harm to inmates because there's guards bringing in illegal drugs and inmates. There's no, in the complaint, it didn't allege that Seth took the drugs, that he ingested the drugs on his own. We don't know whether he took those drugs on his own. We know he died from drugs.
There's nothing in the record saying anybody forced the drugs down his throat.
No.
No, but you do have a lot of different allegations from paragraphs 28 through 34 that suggest information pertaining to Zecora himself. So paragraph 30 says that this prisoner specifically gave defendant Chrisman information about individuals supplying large amounts of drugs to Mr. Zecora. That's one of your allegations. Then apparently in 34 you say two corrections officers told Zecora that he'd gotten himself into this mess, i.e. into the drug problem at Lakeland, and now it was his problem to deal with. So it sounds like, and I'm skipping over several other paragraphs, but you have tied Zecora's situation to the drugs coming in and to knowledge that Chrisman had pertaining to Zecora himself.
Yes, Your Honor. And plaintiff would argue that those kites are going, if they're going straight to Inspector Chrisman, that the other inspector also had knowledge, as well as the warden, because if there's a information being given to the inspectors are the criminal and security investigators for the entire prison. If they're getting tips that guards are committing illegal acts and putting prisoners at risk of overdose, the chain of command would allow an inference that Warden Hoffner, as well as the other inspector, were also aware of this information and failed to act in response to their knowledge that there was uncontrolled guard-led smuggling in there and posing risks to plaintiff of overdose. And drugs in prison do give a serious risk of overdose to prisoners.
Are all prisoners or only those who are known to be drug abusers? I mean, what class does your client Zecora fit into?
Because
he was generally a prisoner in Unit C?
For example, one of the incidents not in Lakeland, when the employee went forward and told supervisory officials that, you know, this inmate told me that there is guards smuggling drugs and here's the name of the other inmate, well, later those two inmates were killed. And they weren't doing drugs, but the fact is that illegal drug smuggling and drug trafficking is trafficking and is inherently dangerous, and not only to people for overdosing, but because of the violence that comes with drug trafficking. And so, does that answer your question, Your Honor?
I guess. Well, I mean, is part of your allegations that Zecora, these officials should have known that Zecora in particular was somebody who was at risk because of these rampant drugs in the prison, as you say?
Yes, as a result of the prisoner informing the inspector that these drugs were being smuggled in and given directly to Seth. So they had specific knowledge that these drugs were coming in through him, which would put him as a target of violence and of a risk of overdose if he's using any of these drugs. And it is, the prison officials do have an obligation to provide reasonable safety. And so reasonable safety would include doing something in response to knowing that there's illegal activity by your employees in the facility.
What's your best case on the clearly established prong for this kind of voluntary conduct by inmates?
Well, so the voluntariness issue, recently in Rhodes versus Michigan, this court actually addressed the voluntariness issue. And in that case, it's an Eighth Amendment
That's
claim.
The employment one where the person takes a job?
Yes.
Right, and then something falls on them?
She's pushing the laundry cart and it falls.
Yeah, but what I mean by voluntary, I should put it differently, voluntarily engaging in illegal conduct. What's the case that establishes that?
I don't have a case that specifically establishes that, Your Honor.
But why isn't that a problem on the clearly established prong? I mean, that's a pretty significant rule. That's not asking for a case decided on a Tuesday at 3 o'clock. That's a pretty significant rule and doctrinal point.
Yes, Your Honor. However, the Supreme Court has gone through for many years and discussed how drugs aren't allowed in prisons, and prison officials do have to combat drugs in prisons. And then in the circuits, there have been some circuit courts that discuss also the dangers of drugs in prisons. So, and given the illegal nature
Drugs in prisons, the more there are cases saying stop the drugs from getting into the prisons, the more you would expect a cognizable Eighth Amendment claim where an estate sues the prison for letting these drugs get in and their child dying from an overdose.
I understand, Your Honor. However, just because there's not a specific case where this has happened before with egregious behavior of illegal conduct happening by state employees in prisons, smuggling these drugs in to create a dangerous environment, I think that would be an obvious case following. Well, there's Motorwell versus Cuyahoga County in the Sixth Circuit that said if any reasonable official would determine that the conduct was unconstitutional, you don't need a case on point. And that's following Supreme Court precedent like Pope versus Pelzer. And plaintiff would argue here that the illegal nature of smuggling drugs in and the inherent dangers in illegal drugs generally, not just in prisons, but generally through violence and overdose, make this an obvious case.
Well, I think I get your obviousness point in part because I get the point that it's obvious prisons should not be allowing drugs in. It's obvious if they know about it, they should stop it. What's not obvious is the person that voluntarily engages in the illegal conduct. You know, this would be a different case if the person arrived and they're going through detox. I mean, that would strike me as a slightly different case. They've been addicted to something, say fentanyl. They come in and they're getting access to, that's a special needs situation. They're particularly vulnerable to something that I could start to see. But here, they're not supposed to be doing this. And that seems to me a very significant difference from those cases. So I don't consider that, frankly, obvious that you have a cognizable Eighth Amendment claim. It's a little bit like you're not supposed to have cigarettes in the prison. Somehow they're there. You're not supposed to be smoking them. Someone smokes them. Then they sue the prison for lung cancer.
Well, that's
voluntarily.
Happened in Helling versus McKinney.
What's that?
That's what happened in Helling versus McKinney. The Supreme Court case determined that a cognizable claim could potentially be stated from a secondhand environmental or secondhand smoke, and they remanded that case back down to determine.
Okay, so I don't know the case, but I want to make sure you listen to what I said before you say it's the same case. I'm talking about someone who voluntarily smokes the cigarettes in a prison. They're not supposed to be smoking them in the prison. They get lung cancer, not secondhand smoke. They're the ones smoking them.
I understand.
They're the ones engaging in the illegal conduct, and they sue the prison for lung cancer. That seems to me extraordinary. And that's not that case, I don't think.
No, that case is, no, I misunderstood your question. That just, this secondhand smoke could create a vile Eighth Amendment claim for your
lung. Totally different line of cases, I agree, because that's the... you're stuck. You can't go anywhere. That's the whole point of that line of cases.
You know, you're stuck there. And I would argue the same thing counts as he can't leave the prison. He can't go get any help. And he did want help. There's allegations that he called his grandma. He said he's scared. He's not going to be able to leave.
Wouldn't he have been just as vulnerable to fentanyl overdoses outside the prison?
There was no one outside the prison was smuggling drugs to him or giving him drugs specifically. He wasn't in prison on a drug charge. So
was he in prison for?
I believe something with criminal sexual conduct.
All right, we'll give you your full rebuttal.
Thank you.
We'll hear from, I guess there are two lawyers on the other side. Mr. Farrell.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Jim Farrell from the Michigan Attorney General's Office on behalf of the 8 Michigan Department of Corrections defendants. I'm going to split my time with my co-defendant. I'll take 8 minutes, and she's going to take 7 minutes for our 15 minutes. And I don't have a lot to say as appellees, obviously. You know, we support the rationale of the lower court.
Why not make this easier and just go to prong 2 of qualified immunity, clearly established?
That's exactly correct. I agree with that. You know, it's interesting. In the lower court, neither the magistrate judge, who wrote a very well-researched report and recommendation, nor the district judge ever mentioned or went through the qualified immunity analysis.
Well, be careful with that. This is a mistake people make all the time. You're always doing the qualified immunity analysis when you do the constitutional ruling. Do you understand that? This is what leads to all kinds of confusion throughout the court. That is part of the qualified immunity analysis. It's just the first prong. And you can win on the first prong, you can win on the second prong. So I'd be careful how you say that.
Well, it's interesting you say that.
But anyway, why did they do it on prong 1? Why didn't they do prong 2? What was going on? It seems like that was easier way to do
it's
it.
It's interesting. The lower court granted, so we both defendants filed motions to dismiss under Rule 12 and motions for summary judgment, you know, combined motions under Rule 56. The court, it seems to me the court granted the motions to dismiss on Rule 12, that there was failure to plead a claim, that there was plausibility issues, Iqbal and Twombly plausibility problems. So it sounded like a Rule 8 dismissal of the case, yet the order says motion for summary judgment granted. So it's a little confusing how the case comes up to the court.
Well, why isn't the complaint sufficient vis-a-vis Defendant Chrisman?
Because what's alleged against Chrisman is that an unknown person at an unknown time told Mr. Chrisman, who is the facility inspector, who's essentially the sheriff of the facility, that Zecora was mixed up with drugs. There's no allegation that that Mr. Chrisman actually inferred that this was a serious risk to his health, that he might overdose on the
drugs. Wouldn't it be logical if there are a lot of drugs coming into prison, and if the drugs in particular are large amounts of drugs are being supplied to Zecora, wouldn't there be a logical inference that there is a serious risk of harm to people like Zecora and including Zecora?
Not necessarily. There's a lot of reasons why someone might have drugs.
In prison?
In prison, to sell them, to make a profit. Now, the inference here that he needs to draw for plaintiff to make a viable Eighth Amendment claim is that he drew this inference that it was a serious risk of overdose.
Well, you're getting to the subjective harm. Do you concede that there is an objective risk here?
No, I don't. The reason why is that's another thing that troubled me with the lower court's decision. I mean, generally I agree with it because we won, but on the first prong, you know, is there a constitutional right that was violated? Is there a constitutional violation? I have yet to see any case that has said that a prisoner has a constitutional right to a drug-free prison environment, or that there would be a violation of his Eighth Amendment rights by him taking a voluntary drug overdose. I mean, there's no constitutional law on either one of those points. They
make
a very...
Does a prisoner have an Eighth Amendment right to have a safe environment in the prison?
Yes, that's correct. But that's too broad. I think as we know in qualified immunity, you have to look at the constitutional right in the somewhat narrow context of the case. Now, of course, the Supreme Court, the Sixth Circuit, every circuit has said there's a right, you know, there's a requirement to protect against known serious risks to a prisoner's safety. But in the specific context of this case, I have yet to see any cases, one case, that has said that there is a constitutional right to a drug-free environment, or that there is that a prisoner has a constitutional right to be protected from himself voluntarily taking it.
What about the fact of the two prior overdoses just within 48 hours, though, of this overdose?
I'm sorry, what was the
first one? Weren't there two prior overdoses in C unit?
Yes, there was. It occurred on January 20th, 21st, and then so there's an OD on Friday the 20th, on Saturday the 21st, and then Mr. Zecora died Sunday morning at 6 a.m.
All right, so why after the first death, or I'm not death, but overdose, or the second overdose, why weren't these officials, including Chrisman, immediately investigating what's going on in C unit?
Well, we
bring the dog in to sniff it out then, or to do some investigation.
I could discuss that, but there's no record in the case. We haven't.
But this is a dismissal on failure to state a claim, so there wouldn't be any evidence. The question is the allegation sufficient to allow the case to go forward?
No, because the allegations are not plausible against any of the defendants. Particularly against the six high-ranking defendants. I think it's a different claim of deliberate indifference.
Well, the allegations on Chrisman are that Chrisman was told about the drug smuggling ring prior to Zecora's death, and Chrisman was told that individuals were supplying large amounts of drugs to Mr. Zecora. That Chrisman didn't do anything to investigate, even when the two other inmates had overdosed in the 2 days prior. And I'm just reading from the complaint. The complaint also says that while Zecora died from a fentanyl overdose, it was not determined whether Mr. Zecora intentionally took those drugs. So that's leaving that open to determine with proper discovery, which never occurred here.
Well, if I understand the question is, why aren't those allegations sufficient
right
to state a claim for the case to go forward?
Vis-a-vis Chrisman.
Well, again, it's implausible that there's no allegation, I should say, that Chrisman drew the inference that there was a serious risk of an overdose death by Seth Zecora, simply because he has a connection to a drug smuggling ring inside the prison.
How would a person such as Zecora's estate be able to get that kind of information about whether Chrisman drew the inference without having discovery?
Well, that's an interesting point. Certainly they could take his deposition, but and even then, I mean,
how could they get it otherwise than through discovery?
Well, I suppose they could. I haven't thought of that, but how could they find if he drew an inference
right
that there was a risk of harm specifically to Zecora for an overdose? I don't know. I guess you'd have to look at...
You're putting it in a position, the estate in a position where they cannot possibly win by any complaint unless they have somehow information that fell into their laps.
Well,
about
one of the problems is...
Unless you emphasize prong two of qualified immunity, where they have all the information they need, just read the law.
Of course. But to answer your question, Judge Sutton, Judge Moore, you know, I mean, the magistrate judge addressed that in the R&R. You know, there's a mechanism under Rule 12D. If you need, you know, in response to a motion, if you need discovery and you don't have the information, you need discovery.
That's if it's converted to summary judgment. But he did this on Rule 12B6 as to all the MDOC people, other than Mobley and Johnson, which are different people. They were, but how big is Unit C, by the way? I mean, are there 100 prisoners?
No, oh no, no. This was just a room. It was a they call it a cube. I think there were six or eight bunk beds. So there's either 12 or 14 or 16 men in this room in bunk beds.
Okay, so you already have two that overdosed one day and 2 days before Zecora. That's getting, so you'd be thinking something's going on in that little quad.
I'm sure, and I would be speculating here because we don't have a record, but I think they did think that. I think there was action taken.
Yeah, after Zecora died.
Well, it was over a weekend. I don't know exactly, again, we haven't done discovery, and I don't know exactly what steps anybody took on Friday night when the first man overdosed. I think he was taken to the hospital. The second man overdosed the next day. He was not taken to the hospital. They gave him a shot of Narcan, and he stayed in the facility. And then Saturday night, that Zecora passed away in his bunk. And he was found on Sunday morning at 7 a.m. Thank you.
Ms. Barranco? Morning.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Assistant Attorney General Kyla Barranco, on behalf of the defendants' appellees for MSP, which would be Heather Last, James Blodkin, James Coleman, and Brandon Oates, and I have reserved 7 minutes for oral argument. As to plaintiff's single claim against the MSP defendants, this court should affirm the district court for two reasons. First, plaintiff's complaint contains only conclusory allegations, which is insufficient to maintain a claim under Rule 12b-6. And second, and alternatively, Your Honors, the district court properly concluded that the MSP defendants were entitled to qualified immunity because plaintiffs did not allege a constitutional violation occurred and because there's no clearly established law to demonstrate that a constitutional right exists. As to the Rule 12b-6 motion, Your Honors, plaintiff's complaint falls short of the pleading standards set forth in both Iqbal and Twombly. Those standards require both plausible and non-conclusory allegations, which plaintiff failed to plead against the MSP defendants. For example, plaintiffs assert that the MSP defendants, and I quote, knew and or participated in the drug smuggling and knew of the risks and harm associated with dangerous illegal drugs. So while plaintiffs assert that this allegation is indeed a fact, and it is actually a conclusion, all plaintiffs have done is set forth the standard for deliberate indifference, knowledge of a risk, and failure to take reasonable steps to abate it, and nothing more, Your Honor, and that's consistent with the other sparse allegations against the MSP defendants. As to the qualified immunity issue, Your Honors, plaintiffs cite not a single case below that stands for the proposition that there is a clearly established right to have police officers protect inmates.
She's saying, okay, fine, there are no cases. That's not helpful and clearly established, but then she's relying on the Hope versus Peltzer line of cases that says you don't need an exact case if it's sufficiently obvious. Isn't it obvious that you should keep drugs out of prisons? Isn't it obvious there are risks if you don't keep drugs out of prisons? I think that's her prong two argument.
Well, it's interesting, Your Honor. All of those cases cited by plaintiff and below, they relied exclusively on Farmer versus Brennan. It was all prison officials that had a duty to protect the prisoners. And in this case, I believe there are a few cases in which perhaps sheriff's officers, when they run the prison, who have a duty to protect prisoners, those are really the only cases that involve police officers having an affirmative duty to protect. There's been no cases cited that police officers who have no duty to run the prison have that obligation.
Police officers, and I feel like I've seen police officers involved in detox cases where people die after being arrested and they're being processed and they're detoxing and, they run into problems. I guess I feel like I've seen officers in that setting.
Your Honor, I'm not aware of any, but in those cases, it seems akin to the suicide cases as it relates to failure to protect or deliberate indifference as to a medical condition. And in those cases, what is required is not just a general awareness that there is a drug problem in prison, but a subjective awareness that that prisoner has a drug problem or is of a suicide risk, and that they're aware of that problem and they failed to abate it. And here we don't have those facts.
So I'm trying to figure out what the facts are that are alleged in the complaint. And what I'm seeing is paragraph 41, which lists the MSP officers and says that the troopers knew that an officer was the person bringing Suboxone and heroin into the facility but didn't investigate the allegation in determining the source of drugs that caused Mr. Zecora's death. Is that the essence of the claim against your clients?
Or? Correct, Your Honor. And as to paragraph 41, by plaintiff's own admission, that was told to one of the officers after Mr. Zecora's death, not before.
Was that the sole theory by which the drugs got into the prison, through help of an officer?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe the sole theory is that an officer helped by throwing basketballs filled with fentanyl and heroin over the fence.
So you're saying that because your clients, the MSP officers, didn't know about this till after Mr. Zecora's death, they couldn't be liable?
Correct, Your Honor. And they were aware on January 20th that there was an overdose in the prison. So on January 20th, there was a critical incident report filed with the MSP, and there was an investigation open into that fact. But they were not aware.
Why isn't the possibility that one of the officers is the basketball thrower?
Well, Your Honor, plaintiff has actually in their briefing indicated that's an MDOC officer.
Mm-hmm. That was the Jane Roe person?
Correct.
Right. Now there's a subsequent amendment that was denied as futile or something that named who that Jane Doe was.
That is correct, Your Honor. However, even in plaintiff's brief in opposition to defendant's motion for summary disposition below, they cited to, or they actually they included exhibits which showed that in the MSP report that they were only told after the fact that a cop officer was the one bringing these drugs into the prison.
Hmm. Well, did the MSP defendants, did they file affidavits or?
They did below.
Okay, so was it summary judgment really more than 12B6 as far as your clients are concerned?
We argued alternatively for qualified immunity summary judgment, and the district court, it adopted, of course, the report and recommendation. The report and recommendation said that the defendant MSP's motion to dismiss / motion for summary judgment was granted.
But did the magistrate judge look at any evidentiary material, or did the magistrate judge decide this simply on the basis of the complaint?
There was two separate analyses, one under 12B6 where they did not look at any evidentiary material, and one under Rule 56 where they did in fact look at the evidentiary material.
Vis-a-vis your clients?
Vis-a-vis my clients, as well as what plaintiffs submitted in response to our motion for summary judgment, which was a significant case critical incident report from the Michigan State Police outlining what they found out during their investigation.
Yeah, it sounded like they did find out during their subsequent investigation that there was an officer involved, right?
In fact, what they found out was that a prisoner had supplied the drugs to Mr. Zecora, and he was subsequently arrested.
Right, but that one who was getting the drugs from some officer, presumably sending it in with basketball.
I believe that's unclear, but to the extent any officer was bringing the drugs into the prison, it was an MDOC officer and not an MSP official. I'm happy to answer any questions Your Honors have, but otherwise I would thank you and ask you to affirm.
Great, thank you. All right, Ms. Sinkovich, you've got your rebuttal.
I want to respond to a couple points made by my opposing counsel. First of all, for drawing the inference of this under this second prong of the deliberate indifference analysis. In Farmer v. Brennan, the court did explain that whether a prison official has knowledge of a substantial risk can be drawn from circumstantial evidence, and a fact finder may conclude that a prison official knew of substantial risk from the very fact that the risk was obvious. And so that would be our response to how Chrisman did have subjective knowledge of the risk of harm to Seth. Whether or not he drew that inference, that's a difficult question, really. However, it's obvious here that the risk was, that there was lots of evidence of the risk, and the circumstantial evidence allows a fact finder to conclude that the defendant did know because the risk was obvious. And then as to the voluntariness that has been raised a few times, I just wanted to read the quote from Rhodes, which is, "A prison official deliberate indifference to a substantial risk of harm violates the Eighth Amendment. As simple as that, the case law does not call for an inquiry into voluntariness or compulsion." And then I also wanted to point the court to a Seventh Circuit case that I cited in the brief that states that prison officials have an obligation to intervene when they know a prisoner suffers from self-destructive tendencies, and that would be in this case taking illegal drugs.
Well, so just so on that one, does a complaint refer to special needs, special medical needs? Your complaint?
No.
Isn't that, that sounds like a special medical needs situation.
Self-destructive tendencies.
Right, so suicide.
Well, they here, Chrisman knew that the large drugs were being given to Seth, so I would compare that potentially to that case where there's a risk of harm to him.
Or that he's a dealer.
There's no, that's not been alleged at all, and there's been no discovery, so there's really no way that we knew that. I don't think that there's any evidence or allegations that he was giving the drugs to anybody else. However, that there were drugs being smuggled in by officers was so obvious to people in prison that actually a previous lawyer in this case, I did explain in the briefing, received a call during dispositive motions from a prison official, a prison guard, who said, here are the names of the three people who were involved in smuggling the drugs that killed Seth. And those three people are named. It's Tammy, Blair, Chase. I can't remember the two other names right now, but Jane Doe was named. A prison official did call and tell us, like, I have to give this information. This is what I know. And did inform counsel of the names of those Jane Does, and the Jane Doe and the two people she was working with, which allowed plaintiff to file that motion for leave to amend the complaint to include those names. And I also wanted to note that the informant, the prisoner who came forward to Inspector Chrisman, in the documentation it states that he was a documented informant. So he wasn't just like a random person who was giving information to try to confuse people or to get himself out of trouble. He was a documented informant in the MDOC who discussed drugs with inspectors in the prisons before. And the critical incident report that we attached to our response to their motions was something that we received through FOIA. That's the only information that we were able to receive, was the critical incident report done by the MDOC and MSP individuals in this case. And I also wanted to, my time is up. I apologize, Your Honors. Thank you.
Okay, thanks to all three of you for your arguments and briefs. We appreciate it. The case will be submitted. And